This is just gold. We have to talk about this. This is so important. It's so important because it's not important. He will lead us out again, at whatever cost to himself. He is surer of finding the way home in the blind of night than the cats of Queen Baruthiel. Ho ho ho. Ho ho ho, we come to it at last. Queen Baruthiel.
Book four, or sorry.
Not that far.
No. Book two, chapter four, Journey in the Dark.
Yeah, so today, this will be similar to like the last chapter where there's just a bunch of minor stuff, minor events that we got to go over and everything, and then they're definitely progressing along, so I mean, that's good.
It's a good plot chapter.
Well, if we get one more plot chapter after this, that'll probably be the longest streak we've had.
I know. So many things happening.
Usually there's just a rest stop by now, but we haven't gotten there yet. Yeah, so we'll talk about them getting to Moria and then all the stuff that happens inside. And they get to the big dwarf city, which this kind of prompts us back to one of the topics we missed when we did the Music of the Ainur special, comparing Aule and Melkor, and so I figured we could wrap that in if we just discuss the origins of the dwarves as a whole, because I think this would be the appropriate spot.
Yeah, it's exciting.
All right, but before that, Cliff's notes.
Okay, so if you remember from the last episode, the company was beaten back by Khaathras, which was the mountain that they tried to go over the top of. So the company weighs their options. Gandalf reluctantly proposes an alternative route, Moria. Everyone recoils in fear and makes their objections, but it becomes clear that that's the only way forwards. That night, they're waylaid by wargs, which are evil orc wolf creatures. In a show of fire and light, the company repels their attackers. In the morning, they make haste to find the Dimrill Gate, which is hidden in stone. When they find it at last, it bears a riddle of elvish runes. While danger lurks around them, the Fellowship makes it into the gates of Moria, and the return entry is blocked. Everything is dark, and they proceed into Moria. All is quiet, or so it seems. As they work their way deeper into the mountain, their uneasiness grows. On the third day, they come to a room where they find the tomb of Balin, the dwarf.
Nice. All right. Well, that was pretty quick for a lot of stuff that happened, but yeah.
Yeah, I figured I'd keep it nice and light because...
Okay, yeah, because we go into it.
keep people on the edge of their seats.
What? How'd you feel about this chapter?
It was another fun one. Yeah. Spooky.
Yeah.
Maybe most spooky... Not the most spooky. Some of the Black Rider stuff at the book one was creepy. But this was... I don't know. Felt like the most dangerous that things have been so far.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, those wolves were close, and then Moria doesn't seem like a wholesome spot.
Yes. Yeah, the wolf attack, that would have been some pretty climactic action in The Hobbit, and here it was, you know, just a few paragraphs.
Right. Well, we'll get to that. So yeah, so like you were saying, the group comes off Khaathras and they settle for the night, and they're trying to decide the next move. I thought the lines there were interesting, that Gandalf says, there's no choice but to go on, or we gotta just return to Rivendell. And then Frodo has that line.
I wish I was back there, but how can we return without shame, unless there is indeed no other way, and we are already defeated?
You were right, Frodo. said Gandalf. To go back is to admit defeat, and face worse defeat to come. If we go back now, then the ring must remain there. We shall not be able to set out again. Then, sooner or later, Rivendell will be besieged, and after a brief and bitter time, it will be destroyed. The Ringwraiths are deadly enemies, but they are only shadows yet of the power and terror that would possess if the ruling ring was on their master's hand again.
Then we must go on, if there is a way, said Frodo with a sigh. Sam sank back into gloom.
There is a way that we may attempt, said Gandalf. I thought from the beginning, when I first considered this journey, that we should try it. But it is not a pleasant way, and I have not spoken of it to the company before. Aragorn was against it until the pass over the mountains had at least been tried.
If it is a worse road than the Redhorn Gate, then it must be evil indeed, said Merry. But you had better tell us about it, and let us know the worst at once.
The road that I speak of leads to the mines of Moria, said Gandalf. Only Gimli lifted his head. A smoldering fire was in his eyes. On all the others a dread fell at the mention of that name. Even to the hobbits it was a legend of vague fear.
The road may lead to Moria, but how can we hope that it will lead through Moria, said Aragorn darkly.
Okay, so there's the plot for the chapter.
Yeah.
Tension. This place is going to be dangerous. It's going to be hard to get there. You know, like, yeah, this won't be, yeah, won't be pleasant, as Gandalf said.
Yes, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. Or stuck between a rock and a hard place and quitting.
Right, well, so the quitting part, I mean, another noble lines here that it's like, okay, we can't go back at this point. If we go back, then we're defeated. You know, like, there's no mm-hmm. second try at this. You can't just start and then go for a retry. Like, they're committed now.
Right.
Which is excellent. I love that.
Mm-hmm. Boromir puts up some protest. He says, well, you know, we could go further south. We could go through the Gap of Rohan, down, you know, in the direction of my people, by Gondor. Or we could go way south, towards Langstrand and Lebanon, which is by South Gondor, all the way by the sea, and come to Mordor that way.
Right. Gandalf says, okay, so the Gap of Rohan's out because we can't take the ring anywhere close to Isengard. Because the Gap of Rohan, so if you go all the way down to the bottom of the Misty Mountains, that's where we had said Isengard is. That's also where the Gap of Rohan is. Because then when you go down there, besides that gap, then you get the White Mountains running east to west. And mm-hmm. so it makes like an upside down T with the gap in the middle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They can't go that way. So the other option that Boromir was saying was, why don't we go all the way around those White Mountains at the very bottom and just like go right next to the sea? If you look at a map and then you see it go around the White Mountains, that, mm-hmm. you know, that could also be an option. But Gandalf is saying like, no, that'll just take way too long. Plus there's always spies everywhere. Our objectives here are speed and secrecy.
But now, do we have any idea why Moria is such a bad option? Or everyone's so scared of it?
We had heard from Gloin that Balin and his people went there and tried to set up shop, remember?
Mm-hmm.
That was mm-hmm. the opening to the Council of Elrond.
But we've talked about Moria before also.
Right. So they were all driven out by Durin's Bane.
Okay.
The dwarf, because this is originally where Durin's people lived, and then they moved to the Lonely Mountain after that.
This was like the most epic dwarf kingdom.
Right. And so then they moved to the Lonely Mountain, but then there was like all those wars between the goblins and the dwarves.
Mm-hmm.
And like the final battle was right outside Moria, and that's where like Thorin was fighting, and that's where he got the name Thorin Oakenshield, because he used like a branch to kind of save him and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that, I think, chapter 4 of The Hobbit. So you go to that episode if you want more details on it. But yeah, so Moria, last they had heard, Balin had tried to go reset it up, but they haven't heard from him in probably like 5 or 10 years, so they're pretty worried. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so now the company's going to try to do this, which maybe not the mm-hmm. best option, you know.
Yes. So Gandalf declares, we can't go over the mountains nor around them, but we have to go under them.
Since our open attempt on the mountain pass, our plight has become more desperate. I fear I see now little hope if we do not vanish from sight for a while and cover our trail. Therefore, I advise that we should go neither over the mountains nor around them, but under them. That is the road, at any rate, that the enemy will least expect us to take. So again, it's like the least expected action. Like we saw that in the Council of Elrond. Like, okay, elves, we usually just go west and call it a day and go to Valinor. But not this time. We're going to do the hard road, the unexpected road. And so that's exactly what they're doing here. We're going to take Moria, which is, if for travel purposes, this is our worst option. But for mm-hmm. the purpose of the mission, at least Gandalf thinks it's the best.
Yes.
Right.
And everyone's so against it that Boromir compares the name of Moria to Mordor itself.
Right, and Gandalf says, hey, It's not as evil as Mordor. Those who pass the gates of Barad-dûr do not return. That's the Dark Tower. But I would not lead you into Moria if there was no hope of coming out again.
Gimli, meanwhile, is like actually a little bit... He's, I won't say excited, but he's definitely interested.
Well, his eyes were smoldering.
To go back
to his homeland, you know?
It's like a combination. He's curious about... How's he related to Balin? Is he like an uncle? Or just a close compatriot?
Yeah, cousin of some kind.
Okay. So Balin, he thinks, is there. Plus there's this, like, all dwarves see this as their ancient homeland that was taken from them. So there's sort of like a revenge, redemption thing going on.
Yeah. It's like, I don't really know a good example for us. What do you think? You think of an example?
No.
Maybe it would be like people from Chernobyl in like 50 years if they went back. You know, and it was like, I don't know, not going to be radioactive.
Okay.
I don't know.
They have some hope that maybe they could reclaim their land that was sort of destroyed.
Yeah, yeah. Like, imagine it was like a really fruitful and glorious land, and then a nuclear bomb went off and they had to leave. But then maybe they could go back and it would be better again. Or at least they just want to see it once. Anyways, what is Aragorn talk about there? Because he actually agrees, he finally relents and agrees to follow Gandalf, but then what does he say?
He gives a little bit of a, would you call it a prophecy?
Yes.
Okay, so he says, "You followed my lead almost to disaster in the snow, and have said no word of blame. I will follow your lead now, if this last warning does not move you. It is not of the ring, nor of us others that I am thinking now, but of you, Gandalf. And I say to you, if you pass the doors of Moria, beware."
Okay, that's quite foreshadowing. We'll have to see how that plays out. Now, meanwhile, Boromir says he'll go if everybody else says they will. Legolas is against it, and then Frodo decides he kind of just wants to sleep on the choice. "I do not wish to go, but neither do I wish to refuse the advice of Gandalf. I beg there should be no vote until we have slept on it. Gandalf will get the votes easier in the light of morning than in this cold gloom. How the wind howls."
Aragorn leaps to his feet. "Declares how the wind howls," he cried. "It is howling with wolf voices. The wargs have come west of the mountains."
"Then need we wait until morning?" said Gandalf. "It is as I said. The hunt is up. Even if we've lived to see the dawn, who now will wish to journey south by night with the wild wolves on his trail?"
"How far is Moria?" asked Boromir.
"There is a door southwest of Carathas, some 15 miles as the crow flies, and maybe 20 as the wolf runs," answered Gandalf grimly.
"Then let us start as soon as it is light tomorrow, if we can," said Boromir. "The wolf that one hears is worse than the orc that one fears."
"True," said Aragorn, loosening his sword in its sheath. "But where the warg howls, there also the orc prowls."
"I wish I'd taken Elrond's advice," muttered Pippin to Sam. "I am no good after all. There's not enough of the breed of Bandabrus, the bull roarer, in me. These howls freeze my blood. I don't even remember feeling so wretched."
"My heart's right down to my toes, Mr. Pippin," said Sam. "But we aren't eaten yet, and there are some stout folk here with us. Whatever may be in store for old Gandalf, I'll wager it isn't a wolf's belly." All right, so kind of interesting. So the choice is made for him by the wolves that, okay, we're going to do Moria. Mm-hmm. And then Pippin, moment of, you know, huge doubt, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Sam reassuring him, which is nice. All this is kind of like obvious, but it's just like, it's just all good to note.
Yeah, I also feel like we can reflect back on this after Moria, but considering how big of an impact Moria has on the story, it almost feels like Tolkien threw this little bit in to kind of punt the, or not punt, like they're chewing on this decision, and then this sort of really just kicks it in one direction. Like, they're kind of forced into it, even though everyone was leaning that way, but they were hesitant. This hearing the wolves sort of locks it up, and then that has a big bearing later on in the story.
What do we think of those little rhymes about the orcs and the wargs?
Kind of funny. It seems like everyone's got their...
Okay, yeah. So those ones I would assume Tolkien made up, but there are, like, a bunch of old English sayings in here, you know, that just sound like just a saying.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those are straight old English, and they kind of like prove the rule in this book, you know, like they're always true, you know, but we'll watch out for those as they come. I don't think these were quite actually done.
Okay.
Okay. Move on to Fellowship Team Builder number 2.
What was team builder number 1?
I would say the whole snow Carathos. On the mountain.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
They had to work together, you know, problem solve, you know.
Right, right.
So here, what do we got? Okay, so they climb up to the top of a small hill, and there's some trees around and some boulders for protection, and they start a fire because it's inevitable that the wolves are going to spot them. Kind of like...
Yeah, seems a little bit like Weathertop.
Yeah, yeah, where Aragorn started the fire just because, like, ah, screw it, the Black Riders are coming. We gotta get ready, you know. So the wolves are getting closer. One of the scouts comes up. Gandalf tries to intimidate it by yelling some threats, but Legolas just shoots it, which was cool. Mm-hmm. And then too good to pass up, so let's go for it. Let's read the scene.
Okay. The night was old, and westward the waning moon was setting, gleaming fitfully through the breaking clouds. Suddenly Frodo started from sleep. Without warning, a storm of howls broke out fierce and wild all about the camp. A great host of wargs had gathered silently and was now attacking them from every side at once.
"Fling fuel on the fire," cried Gandalf to the hobbits. "Draw your blades, and stand back to back."
In the leaping light, as the fresh wood blazed up, Frodo saw many gray shapes spring over the ring of stones. More and more followed. Through the throat of one huge leader, Aragorn passed his sword with a thrust. With a great sweep, Boromir hewed the head off another. Beside them, Gimli stood with his stout legs apart, wielding his dwarf axe. The bow of Legolas was singing. In the wavering firelight, Gandalf seemed suddenly to grow. He rose up, a great menacing shape like the monument of some ancient king of stone set upon a hill. Stooping like a cloud, he lifted a burning branch and strode to meet the wolves. They gave back before him. High in the air he tossed the blazing brand. It flared with a sudden white radiance like lightning, and his voice rolled like thunder.
Nauar en Edrath Amen. Nauar dan e Nargoth. He cried.
There was a roar and a crackle, and the tree above him burst into a leaf and bloom of blinding flame. The fire leapt from treetop to treetop. The whole hill was crowned with dazzling light. The swords and knives of the defenders shone and flickered. The last arrow of Legolas kindled in the air as it flew and plunged burning into the heart of a great wolf chieftain. All the others fled. Slowly the fire died till nothing was left but falling ash and sparks. A bitter smoke curled above the burned tree stumps and blew darkly from the hill as the first light of dawn came dimly in the sky. Their enemies were routed and did not return.
"Well, what did I tell you, Mr. Pippin?" said Sam, sheathing his sword. "Wolves won't get him. That was an eye-opener and no mistake. Nearly singed the hair off my head." So yeah, that was pretty good. I like that. That's like, mm-hmm. That's how you write like a compact, compelling action scene too. Like, that was excellent.
Yeah.
Kind of missed out that wasn't in the movie, but I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I don't know if there was really an excuse for that. Legolas sounded super cool, shooting all the arrows.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been sweet.
I guess this is, strikes me as a little bit weird. Like, this is the first battle scene we've got with the full fellowship assembled. And this is, like, the first all-out. Or we assume that the wargs are kind of in cahoots with Sauron. So this is, like, the first time that the fellowship is coming head-to-head with Sauron in some fashion, right?
Right. Well, that's why I call it a team builder. Like this, yeah, yeah. I think they did better than the first one, where they were all kind of on edge and doing their own thing. Here, it seems like they just kind of worked well together in a battle.
It's true. I guess it's surprising to me that it was such a short little snippet of an encounter. Well, it was just a little tasting.
I think that's kind of cool that he's just so economical about just writing it in and then just keep moving on, you know?
Fair. Okay. So.
Yeah, Gandalf says they got to hustle, got to make it to the door before nightfall because they can't do this another night, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They find some old riverbed. It was Sir Anon, I think, was the river. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the geography's changed. We're not going to mess around with the specifics of it. But then eventually they find out it's like, oh, well, it's because there's this huge dark lake blocking the road to the door of Moria now. Which that wasn't there before.
There used to be maybe a spring with clean water flowing out of the gate and this river kind of careening down the mountain from there.
Because the road goes into a valley and then goes up to the door, but instead of the valley, there's just a lake there.
Right. Implication of dark, still water is, you know, equals death in mythology, but also in life, you know, like it's not safe to drink.
And they said like the water probably, its source was probably somewhere deep in the Misty Mountains, you know.
Hmm.
Where, you know, creepy things like Gollum would live.
Yes.
Okay. So they walk to the northern side of the lake, which wasn't too far, and then right next to the cliffs of Moria, the water is only ankle deep, so they could kind of get through there. Mm-hmm. And they get to these two holly trees at the end of the old road, which signifies that they're at the gates of Moria. So there's only two trees left, because the holly trees were the symbol of Holland, which was the region of the elves that lived there beforehand.
Okay. A long time ago.
Yeah, well, this is where, I think we had said it last episode, but this is where Celebrimbor forged, like, the three rings, and they were friends with the Moria dwarves, and they probably made the seven and the nine rings here, too, with Sauron's help.
Okay.
So this is that area. Let's see, looks like we got a quote. Team builder number three, here we go.
Well, here we are at last, said Gandalf. Here the elven way from Holland ended. Holly was the token of the people of that land, and they planted it here to mark the end of their domain. For the west door was made chiefly for their use in the traffic with the lords of Moria. Those were happier days, when there was still close friendship at times between folk of different race, even between elves and dwarves.
It was not the fault of the dwarves that the friendship waned, said Gimli. I have not heard that it was the fault of the elves, said Legolas.
I have heard both, said Gandalf, and I will not give judgment now. But I beg you two, Legolas and Gimli, at least be friends, and to help me. I need you both. The doors are shut and hidden, and the sooner we find them, the better. Night is at hand.
Okay, so a little bit of tension again. Mm-hmm. Elves and dwarves, I guess natural rivalry a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But certainly a little more lighthearted than we've heard elsewhere.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it wasn't super cold, I'd say. But, you know, this is not the time at all for having any sort of little snippet fights.
Right.
With the wolves somewhere on your tail, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So Gandalf tells him to unload Bill, the pony, and take everything besides the winter provisions because they won't need those because Bill's not going to be able to make it through the mines. And Sam's super distraught about that, and Gandalf basically tells him, hey, you got to decide between Bill or your master Frodo. So toughen mm-hmm. up.
And Gandalf kind of whispers to Bill and tells him, go have some nice grass and find your way back to Rivendell.
Right.
Which is sad, but Gandalf does point out that Bill the horse now has just as good of a chance of surviving as the rest of the company does.
Yeah, he also said it was a bad idea to take the beast in the first place.
That's fair.
They should have picked one that was more detached. Yes. So they're looking for the invisible dwarf door. Classic. Remember that was kind of like we saw that in The Hobbit a little bit.
You yeah, know, the last light of Durin's day.
Right.
Shines on the secret passage into the Lonely Mountain.
Right. So it sounds like this one's a little simpler. You only need moonlight. As okay. opposed to Durin's Day, which mm-hmm. I don't even remember what we decided to... Oh, it happens every year, but it's very hard to tell what day it'll be. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah, okay. So finally, the moonlight does show up, so the dwarf appears. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. At the top, as high as Gandalf could reach, was an arch of interlacing letters and an elvish character. Below, though the threads were in places blurred or broken, the outline could be seen of an anvil and a hammer, surmounted by a crown with seven stars. Beneath these, again, were two trees, each bearing crescent moons. More clearly than all else, there shone forth in the middle of the door a single star with many rays.
There are the emblems of Durin, cried Gimli.
And there is the tree of the High Elves, said Legolas.
And the star of the House of Fëanor, said Gandalf. They are wrought of Ithildin, that mirrors only starlight and moonlight, and sleeps until it is touched by one who speaks words now long forgotten in Middle-earth. It is long since I heard them, and I thought deeply before I could recall them to my mind.
What does the writing say? Asked Frodo, who was trying to decipher the inscription on the arch. I thought I knew the elf letters, but I cannot read these.
The words are in the elven tongue of the west of Middle-earth, in the elder days, answered Gandalf, but they do not say anything of importance to us. They say only... The doors of Durin, Lord of Moria, speak, friend, and enter. And underneath, small and faint, is written, I, Narvi, made them. Celebrimbor of Holland drew these signs.
What does it mean by speak, friend, and enter? Asked Merry.
That is plain enough, said Gimli. If you are a friend, speak the password, and the doors will open, and you can enter.
Yes, said Gandalf. These doors are probably governed by words. Some dwarf gates will open only at special times or for particular persons, and some have locks and keys that are still needed when all necessary times and words are known. These doors have no key. In the days of Durin, they were not secret. They usually stood open, and door wards sat here. But if they were shut, any who knew the opening word could speak it and pass in. At least it is so recorded, is it not, Gimli?
It is, said the dwarf. But what the word was is not remembered. Narvi and his craft, all his kindred, have vanished from the earth.
But do not you know the word, Gandalf? Asked Boromir in surprise.
No, said the wizard.
The others looked in dismay. Only Aragorn knew that knew Gandalf well, remained silent and unmoved. All right, so that's bad news.
Mm-hmm. So they've got a riddle ahead of them.
Well, it turns out to be a riddle, but they just think, like, okay, we got to figure out the password. But Gandalf's pretty confident that he can figure out any sort of door passwords and stuff. So he keeps trying all these spells and everything, and then they're hearing the wolves howl in the background. And so,
meanwhile, there's this kind of a lurking dread of this pond behind them.
Yeah, and Boromir's frustrated, and I don't think he's really even aware of the lurking because he's probably hearing the wolves. But so he's so frustrated, he throws a big stone into the lake.
Yeah, which is bad news.
Right. Well, Frodo's like kind of agitated by that, and then everybody's getting frustrated. So Fleming Rutledge, she points out at this part again, she's always comparing it to like Christian motifs or themes and stuff, and so she notes, like, the bickering at the door of Durin, there are no perfect souls here, you know, Gandalf's salty, Boromir's agitated, Pippin's annoying, Sam's distraught because he's gonna have to get rid of the pony, Legolas is too cool for school, you know, basically nobody, nobody's perfect, and this is also, like, in real life, well, nobody's perfect, and this is who God's, you know, going to choose to, like, work his plan through and stuff. So so encouraging that we could relate to these people here. Mm-hmm. But back to the story. Finally, Gandalf gets it. Duh. It's Melon. And then the door's open.
Which is Elvish for friend.
Right, correct. I was wrong after all, said Gandalf, and Gimli too. Merry, of all people, was on the right track. The opening word was inscribed on the archway all the time. The translation should have been, say friend and enter. I had only to speak the Elvish word for friend, and those doors opened. Quite simple. Too simple for a learned lure master in such suspicious days. Those were happier times. Now let us go. What do you think of that?
Clever. And yeah, definitely much more lighthearted than these dark times. I guess it's worth noting, we commented on Legolas and Gimli snipping at each other about dwarves and elves not being friends. This whole doorway sounds like was meant as like a collaboration between the dwarves and the elves.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to talk about
the doorway. It's got the inscriptions of both of them.
Yeah.
And it was meant, this door specifically was like the commerce point between this elvish land and the dwarvish kingdom in the mountain.
Yeah, okay. And so there's a couple types of elvish writing and languages. And so this was written in basically the High Elves. So these are ones from Valinor, because it's Celebrimbor. Celebrimbor was basically the leader of these people, and he's one of the, he's like a grandson of Fëanor. So this is, as opposed to like Legolas's people, which are kind of like the lower elves, or like the gray elves, or green elves, or like the Sindar, this was mostly the High Elves people. But then, yeah, this was a very profitable relationship with the dwarves of Moria, and it was usually pretty open, and yeah, lots of commerce and traffic.
Mm-hmm. Times were good.
Right. But also cool too, like the writing of this itself was Celebrimbor's own hand, you know, because we were hearing about this guy and it's like, wow, we're seeing like a literal artifact from this dude.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. He strode forward and set his foot on the lowest step, but at that moment, several things happened. Frodo felt something seize him by the ankle, and he fell with a cry. Bill the pony gave a wild neigh of fear, and turned tail and dashed away along the lakeside into the darkness. Sam leaped after him, and then, hearing Frodo's cry, he ran back again, weeping and cursing. The others swung round and saw the waters of the lake seething, as if a host of snakes were swimming up from the southern end. Out of the water, a long, sinuous tentacle had crawled. It was pale green and luminous and wet. Its fingered end had hold of Frodo's foot and was dragging him into the water. Sam, on his knees, was now slashing at it with a knife. The arm let go of Frodo, and Sam pulled him away, crying out for help. 20 other arms came rippling out. The dark water boiled, and there was a hideous stench.
Into the gateway, up the stairs, quick, shouted Gandalf, leaping back, rousing them from the horror that seemed to have rooted all but Sam to the ground where they had stood. He drove them forward.
They were just in time. Sam and Frodo were only a few steps up, and Gandalf had just begun to climb, when the groping tentacles writhed across the narrow shore and fingered the cliff wall and the doors. One came wriggling over the threshold, glistening in the starlight. Gandalf turned and paused. If he was considering what word would close the gate again from within, there was no need. Many coiling arm seized the doors on either side, and with horrible strength swung them round. With a clattering echo they slammed, and all light was lost. A noise of rending and crashing came dully through the ponderous stone. Sam, clinging to Frodo's arm, collapsed on a step in the darkness.
"Poor old Bill," he said with a choking voice. "Poor old Bill. Wolves and snakes, but the snakes were too much for him. I had to choose, Mr. Frodo. I had to come with you."
They heard Gandalf go back down the steps and thrust his staff against the doors. There was a quiver in the stone and the stairs trembled, but the doors did not open.
All right, big stuff.
So there is some sort of sea monster sitting in this lake the whole time.
Right. Well, it was like, they said it was luminous, you know, so that's probably, that seems like something that's underground, you know, so I think it was at the bottom of the Misty Mountains and now it came out.
Oh, interesting. That's a good read. I was going to say pale green and luminous is actually like, it's not colors I associate with Lord of the Rings. Or I take that back. A pale green tentacle that's glowing sounds much more like alien sci-fi.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Than a Lord of the Rings like monster, but I was thinking there's enough like creepy stuff in the dark glowing at various points in Lord of the Rings that maybe it fits. I like the thought that it comes out of a cave.
Right. I think, you know, like those, like on planet Earth, you know, the bugs that live underground, you know.
Or like salamanders or something.
Right. That are super light and they don't even have eyes, you know, because they don't need eyes. But they're like luminous and glowing. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's something like that. But yeah, this is hard to explain. where the hell this thing came from.
Right. And also what the larger bearing is besides this little trip or hiccup into Moria, right?
Well, this is kind of like the back door of Moria. Like, the front door is the other side of the mountains. And so this said at some point, I guess it sounds recently because Gandalf didn't remember this pool being here. This kind of became like the back door guardian almost for probably anything evil.
Oh, okay.
But yeah,
okay.
It's kind of weird.
So some foreboding.
Yeah. I don't know if Tolkien just put it in, though, if he just wanted another like mini adventure, because that was also very quick. And this one, especially in the movie, like that's, I don't know, that's like a 3 or 5 minute sequence, so it's a pretty big memorable.
Yeah, this part gets played up in the movie a little bit. Right?
Memorable big deal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, said the wizard, the passage is blocked behind us now, and there's only one way out, on the other side of the mountains. I fear from the sound that boulders have been piled up, and the trees uprooted, and thrown across the gate. I am sorry, for the trees were beautiful, and they had stood so long.
I felt that something horrible was near me from that moment that my foot first touched the water, said Frodo. What was the thing, or were there many of them?
I do not know, answered Gandalf, but the arms were all guided by one purpose. Something has crept or has been driven out of the dark waters under the mountains. Okay, so Gandalf said it. There are older and fouler things than orcs in the deep places of the world. He did not speak aloud his thought that whatever it was that dwelt in the lake, it had seized on Frodo first among all the company.
Boromir muttered under his breath, but the echoing stone magnified the sound to a hoarse whisper that all could hear. In the deep places of the world, and thither we are going against my wish. Who will lead us now in this deadly dark?
I will, said Gandalf, and Gimli shall walk with me. Follow my staff. Interesting. Okay, so Gandalf was picking up that this thing was also drawn to Frodo, apparently, you know, of everybody. Mm-hmm. That probably wasn't just chance or whatever.
Yes.
Okay, so the most direct route across Moria is going to take 3 to 4 marches. Whatever marches means, probably days.
40 miles, yeah.
40 miles without getting lost.
Mm-hmm. 40 miles as the crow flies, right?
No, I think it was 30 miles straight, but it would take them 40 miles with some winding.
Gotcha.
Not including getting lost. And then, plus the crow can't fly underground, Clifford.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Not even, maybe the bat.
As the bat flies.
But the bat can't fly through walls.
Exactly. I mean, that's the point.
Yeah. Okay, so we're kind of starting to see, too, a little mirroring of The Hobbit a little bit, you know? Because, like, you leave Rivendell, you go up the mountain, you go into the caves. Remember how Bilbo left Rivendell? They went up into the mountains, and then they were on the doorstep of the goblins, and then they went in and had, like, an adventure in all the tunnels of the mountains themselves, you know?
Right. Also sort of a tumultuous entry into the mountain itself.
Yeah.
Like, you pass through some sort of portal that feels almost like a time and space is a little bit warped.
Yep.
Nice. And now you're trapped inside a different place, and that seems like it's functioning from a different time or something like that.
Okay. All right. Oh, this part's great. 303. You want to read that paragraph and then I'll take the next one.
Gimli aided Gandalf very little, except by his stout courage. At least he was not, as were most of the others, troubled by the mere darkness in itself. Often the wizard consulted him at points where the choice of way was doubtful, but it was always Gandalf who had the final word. The mines of Moria were vast and intricate beyond the imagination of Gimli, Glóin's son, dwarf of the mountain race though he was. To Gandalf, the far-off memories of a journey long ago were now of little help, but even in the gloom and despite all windings of the road, he knew whither he wished to go, and he did not falter, as long as there was a path that led towards his goal.
Okay, I'm supposed to read the next paragraph, but are you picking up too how like the language is, these sentences, just the narrator sentences are becoming more epic as we go through this book? Like compare this to like the Shire chapters. I mean, this is, you know, Gimli, Glóin's son, dwarf of the mountain race though he was, you know. Like even the narrator's getting like more into character or something, you know.
Yeah, but I maybe a little bit more archaic too.
Yeah, well, I mean that I think that's a sign of epic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Aragorn's got the, this is just gold. We have to talk about this. This is so important. It's so important because it's not important. Okay. Do not be afraid, said Aragorn. There was a pause longer than usual, and Gandalf and Gimli were whispering together. The others were crowded behind, waiting anxiously. Do not be afraid. I have been with him on many a journey, if never on one so dark. There are tales of Rivendell of greater deeds of his than any that I have seen. He will not go astray, if there is any path to find. He has led us in here against our fears, but he will lead us out again, at whatever cost to himself. He is surer of finding the way home in the blind of night than the cats of Queen Beruthiel. Ho, ho, ho. Ho, ho, ho. We come to it at last. Queen Beruthiel.
Who is Queen Beruthiel?
I was going to ask you. What do you know about her?
Oh. I don't know.
Search your memory of all the time, you know, back when we read the Silmarillion.
I know. Queen Beruthiel. Sounds like Bran and Lúthien, but...
Good guess.
Lúthien's mother.
Totally wrong. Oh. Clifford, this was a trick question. Okay. So, this is why we're actually covering it. Because this is a trick question. Because at the time of the publication of Lord of the Rings, this and maybe the Blue Wizards were the only references that didn't connect to Tolkien's whole mythology, Middle-earth. Like, there was no Queen Beruthiel before this. This is the only reference that doesn't make any sense. You know, like, they're referencing Beren, and they're referencing, like, Turin, and they're referencing Arendelle, you know.
And he had already written the Silmarillion.
Right, he already had those stories in development. He has no idea who Queen Beruthiel is when he writes this, you know. So
just a queen with cats.
Well, luckily, though, he did finally get around to writing something about it. So you have to go to, what did I say? You got to go to Unfinished... All right, so the book Unfinished Tales, this is what... This book was successful enough that it sparked Christopher Tolkien to write the 12 parts of History of Middle-earth, like going through all his dad's notes, because this was just like some really good stories that were unfinished. Obviously, Unfinished Tales. And so there was one chapter, it's in the Istari chapter, who the Istari are, we will talk about a little deep into the show, but it's on page 419 of my book, note 7. Okay, let's see. Ready? I'm going to read this. In a letter written in 1956, my father said, oh, so this is Christopher Tolkien talking. In a letter written in 1956, my father said, there is hardly any reference in Lord of the Rings to things that do not actually exist on its own plane of secondary or subcreational reality. And, added in a footnote to this, the cats of Queen Beruthiel and the names of the other two wizards, 5 minus Saruman, Gandalf, and Radagast, are all that I recollect. So this is back to Christopher Tolkien talking again. Even the story of Queen Beruthiel does exist, however, if only in a very primitive outline, in one part illegible. She was the nefarious, solitary, and loveless wife of Tar-Anon, 12th king of Gondor. So that's like Boromir's people, right? And the first of the ship kings, who took the crown in the name of Falaster, lord of the coast, and was the first childless king. Beruthiel lived in the king's house in Osgiliath, hating the sounds and smells of the sea and the house of Tar-Anon built below Pelagir. So Pelagir's like on the coast of Middle-earth, upon arches whose feet stood deep in a wide water of Ether Anduin. I think ether would be like delta or mouth. Okay. Yeah. Okay. She hated all making, all colors, and all elaborate ornament, wearing only black and silver and living in bare chambers. And the gardens of the house in Osgiliath were filled with tormented sculptures beneath cypresses and yews. She had 9 black cats and 1 white, her slaves, with whom she conversed, or read their memories, setting them to discover all the dark secrets of Gondor, so that she knew those things that men wish most to keep hidden, setting the white cat to spy on the black, and tormenting them. No man in Gondor dared touch them. All were afraid of them, and cursed when they saw them pass. Okay, what follows is almost wholly illegible in a unique manuscript, except for the ending, which states that her name was erased from the Book of the Kings, but the memory of men is not wholly shut in books, and the cats of Queen Beruthiel ever passed wholly out of men's speech, and the king Tar Anon had her set on a ship alone with her cats and set adrift out on the sea before a north wind. The ship was last seen flying past Umbar under a sickle moon with a cat at the masthead and another at the figurehead on the prow. And with that, we know who Queen Beruthiel is.
Thank you. Thank you for filling that in. God forbid we had an unexplained character in here.
I know. But even that, it's like the son's literally picking through history of his dad's history because he can't even read his notes and like figure out what the hell this little mini outline is for this very, 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 as minor character as you could possibly get. Uh-huh. But I love it. and that's the kind of details I expect. Like, this is not only the benchmark of all fantasy, this is like the unassailable, because how do you top that for having a backstory to this reference?
Leave no rock unturned. Yeah. So, moving on, they're working their way deeper into Mordor, jumping over chasms, going through hallways, up staircases, down staircases.
Felt endless.
Yes, yes. Everything's totally dark and silent.
But there's this weird part, like Frodo, I guess it's an effect of the wound that he got at Weathertop. Apparently now he can see better in the dark than any of his companions, which was kind of interesting. And then at times the ring also feels like a literal heavy weight. And then he also thinks that he's hearing some faint footsteps behind that don't belong to the group.
Yeah, he's like, it can't be an echo because they keep going after the group stops and then they stop.
Right.
Sounds kind of like a classic horror story. Yeah. Something, or even like Scooby-Doo, like
right.
Someone creeping behind someone else and they keep walking for an extra second and then pause.
Yeah,
that's the implication at least.
Right. All right, so we will keep tabs on that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, the group comes to an opening with 3 passages and Gandalf can't remember or decide which way to go, so the company halts for the night, in quotes.
Mm-hmm. Although everything's dark, so right. It's hard to tell what's what.
Yeah,
they go off to the side where there's a little guard room, presumably to keep watch over this little juncture back in the day. And there's a deep well in the middle of it.
Pippin felt curiously attracted by the well. While the others were unrolling blankets and making beds against the walls of the chamber, as far as possible from the hole in the floor, he crept to the edge and peered over. A chill air seemed to strike his face, rising from invisible depths. Moved by a sudden impulse, he groped for a loose stone and let it drop. How dumb can you be? He felt his heart beat many times before there was any sound. Then, far below, as if the stone had fallen into deep water in some cavernous place, there was a plunk, very distant, but magnified and repeated in a hollow shaft.
"What's that?" cried Gandalf. He was relieved when Pippin confessed what he had done, but he was angry, and Pippin could see his eye glinting. "Fool of a Took," he growled. "This is a serious journey, not a hobbit walking party. Throw yourself in next time, and then you will be no further nuisance. Now be quiet."
Nothing more was heard for several minutes, but then there came out of the depths of the faint knocks, tom tap, tap tom. They stopped, and when the echoes had died away, they were repeated. Tap tom, tom tap, tap tap tom. They sounded disquietingly like signals of some sort, but after a while, the knocking died away and was not heard again.
"That was the sound of a hammer, or I have never heard one," said Gimli. "Yes," said Gandalf, "and I do not like it. It may have nothing to do with Peregrine's foolish stone, but probably something has been disturbed that would have been better left quiet. Pray, do nothing of the kind again. Let us hope we shall get some rest without further trouble. "You, Pippin, can go on the first watch as a reward," he growled, and he rolled himself in a blanket.
Okay, so I guess we read that because the movie really hypes it up, but this wasn't as big a scene because who knows if the rest of the Moria incidents are really connected to Pippin being such a dope.
Yes, but always a classic refrain, fool of a Took.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, Gandalf can't even sleep, so he basically, without saying sorry, just sends Pippin to bed, you know, and it's just like, all right, don't worry about it. I'll take the watch. And yeah, so Pippin falls asleep. And then Gandalf, he ends up waking them all up again because he decides he's going to go on the right path, like to the right. So the, mm-hmm. the right.
The other ones don't smell right to him.
Did it actually say that?
Yeah, or he's something about at least one of them didn't smell right, and he wants to go up.
Right, he wants to go up, upwards, yeah. But I can't say right without, like, you know, I'm talking directional right as opposed to left, not, like, the right way, though I mm-hmm, guess it ends mm-hmm. up being the right way, you'd think. Okay, so they cover 15 miles straight, but they probably walked, it took them about 20 to do that. They come to a wide hall.
They marched as far as the hobbits could endure without a rest, and all were thinking of a place where they could sleep, when suddenly the walls to right and left vanished. They seemed to have passed through some arched doorway into a black and empty space. There was a great draft of warmer air behind them, and before them the darkness was cold on their faces. They halted and crowded anxiously together.
Gandalf seemed pleased. "I chose the right way," he said. "At last we are coming to the habitable parts. And I guess that we are not far from the eastern side. But we are high up, a good deal higher than the Dimrold Gate, unless I am mistaken. From the feeling of the air, we must be in a wide hall. I will now risk a little real light."
He raised his staff, and for a brief instant there was a blaze like a flash of lightning. Great shadows sprang up and fled, and for a second they saw a vast roof far above their heads, upheld by many mighty pillars hewn of stone. Before them and on either side stretched a huge empty hall, its black walls, polished and smooth as glass, flashed and glittered. Three other entrances they saw, dark black arches, one straight before them eastwards and one on either side. Then the light went out.
"That is all I shall venture on for the present," said Gandalf. "There used to be great windows on the mountainside and shafts leading out to the light in the upper reaches of the mines. I think we have reached them now, but it is night outside again, and we cannot tell until morning. If I am right, tomorrow we may actually see the morning peeping in. But in the meanwhile, we had better go no further. Let us rest if we can. Things have gone well so far, and the greater part of the dark road is over. But we are not through yet, and it is a long way down to the gates that open on the world." Well, that's cool. All right, that's a token detail, too. The having, like, shafts of natural light come into the hall.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, a clever little magical detail, too. And then it's even more of a token detail because it's practical. Like, yeah, but we can't see it because it's night outside as well. You know, it's mm-hmm. just like, it should be there, but we can't see it. But that's a cool thing to imagine, too.
Yeah. It sounds like a super cool building, or yeah. super cool room, at least.
Yeah. Any architecture thoughts?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a good comparison.
I've thought it's like the Egypt columns.
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
Like Hypa style thing or whatever.
Yes. Hey, look at you. You could be leading the architecture lesson here.
No, it's, at some point I left a note. those don't come up often.
if you're curious, there's something coming to mind. If you look up the Valley of the Kings,
yeah,
in ancient Egypt,
this is what I was thinking of. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure there's like maybe it's called like the Temple of the Valley of the Kings or something like that, or the Gates of the Valley of the Gates of the Kings. Anyways, there's a temple in there that's built into the mountain. Like, it starts out looking like a temple front, but then it kind of descends back into the stone. And it's filled with these, like, giant hypostyle halls, like Patrick said. Hypostyle just means it's, like, a forest of columns inside. And, yeah, that's what I imagine the inside of this being, like, set into the mountain. And, like, this maybe epic progression deeper and deeper into the stone. But it's still retained. It's not like you're... This is no sad cave. This is like a really epic, I don't know, relationship with the mountain or something.
Yeah.
Okay. The Temple of Queen Hatshepsut, if anyone's curious. Temple of Queen Hatshepsut in the Valley of the Kings.
Let's see. That's just isn't that the Valley of the Kings? I thought that's just called Valley of the Kings.
Well, the valley is like the actual valley, and then there's
it's a good
example to think about.
Yeah, that thing's sick. I think that goes down as my favorite Egyptian monument. I think I've decided that.
A modern example, if you look up a photo of the Tokyo sewer system, is like totally epic. There's a giant like super drainage tank underneath Tokyo that's like a hypo style cathedral. Isn't it cool?
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty accurate. Not as I bet Moria is more detailed, but
yeah, that's a little bit like Blade Runner looking or something.
I mean, you can't expect too much art in a sewer.
Exactly. Anyways,
okay.
Epic space, clearly reminiscent of this great dwarf kingdom that once was and is no longer.
Let's hear more about it.
Yeah.
The company spent that night in the great cavernous hall, huddled close together in a corner to escape the draft. There seemed to be a steady inflow of chill air through the eastern archway. All about them, as they lay hung in the darkness, hollow and immense, and they were oppressed by the loneliness and vastness of the Dolvin halls and endlessly branching stairs and passages. The wildest imaginings that dark rumor had ever suggested to the hobbits fell together short of the actual dread and wonder of Moria. There must have been a mighty crowd of dwarves here at one time, said Sam, and every one of them busier than badgers for 500 years to make all this, and most in hard rock, too. What did they do it all for? They didn't live in these darksome holes, surely.
These are not holes, said Gimli. This is the great realm and the city of Dwarodelf, and of old it was not darksome, but full of light and splendor, and is still remembered in our songs.
He rose, and standing in the dark, he began to chant in a deep voice while the echoes ran away into the roof.
The world was young, the mountains green, no stain yet on the moon was seen. No words were laid on stream or stone when Durin woke and walked alone. He named the nameless hills and dells. He drank from yet untasted wells. He stooped and looked in Miromir and saw a crowd of stars appear as gems of a silver thread above the shadow of his head. The world was fair, the mountains tall, in elder days before the fall of mighty kings in Nargothrond and Gondolin, who now beyond the western seas have passed away. The world was fair in Durin's day. A king he was on carven throne in many pillared halls of stone, with golden roof and silver floor and runes of power upon the door. Light of sun and star and moon in shining lamps of crystal hewn, undimmed by cloud or shade of night, there shone forever fair and bright. Their hammer on the anvil smote, their chisel clove and graver wrote. Their forge was blade and bound was hilt, their delver mine the mason built, their beryl pearl and opal pale and metal wrought like fish's mail. Buckler and corslet, axe and sword, and shining spears were laid in hall. Unwearied then were Durin's folk. Beneath the mountains music woke, and harpers harped and minstrels sang, and at the gates the trumpets rang. The world is grey, the mountains old, the forge fire is ashen cold, no harp is rung, no hammer falls, the darkness dwells in Durin's halls. The shadow lies upon his tomb in Moria in Khazad Dûm. But still the sunken stars appear and darken windless Miramir. There lies his crown in water deep till Durin wakes again from sleep.
I like that, said Sam. I should like to learn it. In Moria, in Khazad Dûm. But it makes the darkness seem heavier, thinking of all those lamps. Are there piles of jewels and gold lying about here still?
Gimli was silent. Having sung his song, he would say no more. Okay, what do we think of that song?
I feel like I say epic way too much. It feels heavier than some of the elven songs.
Right, compared to elven songs.
There's something about, I don't know if it's just my perception, because I think of the dwarves being in caves and deep booming sounds versus the elves being very delicate, but I feel like even in the types of rhymes are like rounder and deeper, like throne, stone, floor, door.
Yeah, it's plain and direct too.
Yes. But still, still like kind of melancholy, calls up this former glory. Similar to some of the songs of the elves.
I mean, we're building up that we're going to have like a major conversation of that soon. I don't think we should do it this chapter, but like in a couple chapters like this, the melancholy sense of past its prime, like past the golden age. Like we're seeing that just everywhere.
Yes.
You know? And it's helping us to recall all these traditions, which adds the depth to this book and makes it like believable, you know, mm-hmm. like this world's real. But yeah, we're just gonna, at some point soon, we're gonna just address this in a fuller way, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good thing you bring up, is like so much of this so far has been like walking through the ruins of something that once was.
Yeah. I mean, we saw it with Past Bree. There were all the ruins like at Weathertop and everything.
Right.
And then in Rivendell, they're recalling stories of greater glory. Aragorn uh-huh. even was too, and he was talking about Beren and Lúthien.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, definitely as they set out, they went through the land where the rings were made, and there was right. great friendship with the dwarves and elves, and they're also kind of like destroying the stuff on their way too. Like, that's the other thing. It's like, man, that door was really ancient. It was very beautiful, you know, like the dwarf door that they went through. Mm-hmm. And then the sea monster attacks him, and the thing's probably ruined for good, you know.
Yeah,
at the,
yeah.
at the very least, those beautiful trees are gone forever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sucks, you know. So, but it's just, I don't know, it's like these historic things are just like little blips on their just massive great journey, you know.
Yeah.
We could talk about the creation story of the dwarves now, but I think we'll just save it for the end, and let's just finish off the main content of this chapter.
Okay.
So Gandalf, he's telling Sam that Moria is actually known for its mithril as opposed to like gold or silver or anything. Well, I guess mithril is probably like the best silver. So this
is referred to as Moria silver.
Or true silver.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the only place in the world where you can find it, and the dwarves won't even tell their own name for it. You know, like you saw, like, okay, Gimli sang that song and everything, but he was very defensive after that. Like, he wasn't going to say any more about his people. Like, the dwarves, uh-huh. like, they do still have a, like an element where they just keep to their own. Like, there's words that they safeguard and will never name.
Mm.
Which, when they do name it, it's like the jawbreaker language, as Sam says from the last mm-hmm. chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, even here, like, Khazad-dûm is their name for Moria.
Yeah.
But anyways, back to Mithril. It's 10 times more valuable than gold, and that's when people are looking for it. When nobody's looking for it, it's way more expensive than that.
You mean when no one's mining it?
Right, yeah. The dwarves tell no tale, but even as Mithril was the foundation of their wealth, so it was also their destruction. They delved too greedily and too deep and disturbed that from which they fled, Durin's Bane. Of what they brought to light, the orcs have gathered nearly all and given it in tribute to Sauron, who covets it. Sauron really likes Mithril, and then they also mentioned, it was kind of funny, they said Bilbo's coat that he had gotten from Thorin,
uh-huh.
it was probably valued at
all of the Shire and everything in it.
Yeah.
And if you've been paying attention closely, Frodo is wearing that cloak right now.
Right, but nobody else knows that.
Right, he kind of just grabs his collar while they're talking about this.
But yeah, that line there, Mithril, that was, they were real good at finding it, but that was also their destruction, because they went too deep and were too greedy to get it, and they awoke something bad. And Durin's so, Bane,
which
right.
we don't know what that is.
Fleming Rutledge points out, the dwarves exemplify what is the best of what we might call work ethic, and also its greatest temptations. Like, seriously, take for a second, just like think about how hard it was to carve this in the middle of a mountain, like this mm-hmm. whole area and everything, you know. Like, Sam thinks it probably took them like 500 years working their asses off. At the same time, the discovery of Mithril and the greed for more of it led the dwarves so deep into the mines that they unearthed the unspeakable Durin's Bane, and thereby wrought their own downfall through overextension of their own gifts. A tale more often told than not in the history of our own world. In this respect, the dwarves are us. All right, so Frodo thinks he's seeing some luminous eyes in the dark hall now, not just like spooky footsteps or something.
Spooky.
Yeah. Finally, Gandalf says good morning.
Do we have any? We have no idea what these luminous eyes might be. It sounds like, I mean, the implication is it's not an orc or something, right? Because their swords aren't glowing.
Right. I know the story too well to like try to venture a guess. Because I do know what this is. So.
Well, something's... I do, but... something's following them. Yeah, it doesn't seem good, but it doesn't seem evil in the same way that the orcs are.
Okay, and then after that, Gandalf said, good morning, for morning it is again. Let's see, must have been something cool. Good morning, said Gandalf, for morning it is again at last. I was right, you see. We are high up on the east side of Moria. Before today is over, we ought to find the great gates and see the waters of Miramir lying in the Dimrill Dale before us.
I shall be glad, said Gimli. I have looked on Moria, and it is very great, but it has become dark and dreadful, and we have found no sign of my kindred. I doubt now that Balin ever came here.
Okay, so Gandalf was saying he was right, because now they do actually see the natural light shining through those cool shafts to light up the hall, which mm-hmm. is sweet. And then, yeah, it sounds like they're close to the entrance to get out. From there, they follow some of this natural light into a chamber, and then their feet disturbed dust upon the floor and stumbled among things lying in the doorway, whose shapes they could not at first make out. The chamber was lit by a wide shaft high in the further eastern wall. It slanted upwards, and far above, a small square patch of blue sky could be seen. The light of the shaft fell directly on a table in the middle of the room, a single oblong block, about 2 feet high, upon which was laid a great slab of white stone.
It looks like a tomb, muttered Frodo, and bent forwards with a curious sense of foreboding to look more closely at it. Gandalf came quickly to his side. On the slab, runes were deeply graven.
And then you can read the dwarf runes, because they're put in the book. These are Dairon's runes, such as were used of old in Moria, said Gandalf. Here is written in the tongues of men and dwarves, Balin, son of Húndin, lord of Moria.
He is dead then, said Frodo. I feared it was so.
Gimli cast his hood over his face. Okay. And with that, chapter's ended. So Balin was there.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
And has been buried.
All right, I don't know. That was a pretty good chapter, though.
Yeah, quite a bit happened.
Pretty far. That was all right. Seriously, like the past two chapters that we did, that should be like at least three chapters, probably four.
Yeah, like, these have both been long, dense chapters.
Yeah, like they cover so much ground.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but we promise creation story of the dwarves.
Okay, yeah, because we're wondering how did Moria come to be here in the first place?
Well,
at least we're looking for some background about the dwarves.
Yeah, and then we also, like, this is one of the things that we skipped in the Music of the Ainur special that I had ready to go, was talk about Aule and Melkor. So, anyways, so you remember the Music of the Ainur special, right?
Yeah, this is the very opening of the Silmarillion when basically the world is being formed. This is the genesis for the Silmarillion.
Right, but when we ended, we had talked about how the Valar are waiting for the elves and men to awake in Middle-earth, because Iluvatar is just going to has set a time for them to awake, but they don't know when it is.
Right.
But they do know, like, all right, the elves are going to be immortal and the men are going to die. And we talked about the fates in that mm-hmm, special. Mm-hmm. So before that happens, while the Valar are just living in Valinor and Melkor is in the north of Middle-earth and he's basically got the place to himself and Middle-earth is in darkness, everybody's just waiting for the elves to awake because they're the firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
Just waiting and waiting and waiting. And finally, one of the Valar, Aule, who seems like he's third in line of the dudes, because Manwë, Olmo, Aule.
Okay.
So, Aule is getting impatient. I'm going to read the story because it's kind of short, but I think I'll just do it in full. Okay?
Okay.
It is told that in their beginning that the dwarves were made by Aule in the darkness of Middle-earth. For so great did Aule desire the coming of the children to have learners to whom he could teach his lore and his crafts that he was unwilling to await the fulfillment of the designs of Iluvatar. And Aule made the dwarves even as they still are, because the forms of the children who were to come were unclear to his mind, and because the power of Melkor was yet over the earth, and he wished therefore that they should be strong and unyielding, but fearing that the other Valar might blame his work, he wrought in secret, and he made the first of the seven fathers of the dwarves and the hall under the mountains in Middle-earth. With me so far?
Okay, so Aule is pretty much like, I'm not sticking around. I'm not waiting to see the elves and men come out. So
yeah, he's just too impatient, so he tries to create the children himself, okay?
In his garage.
Well, his garage is, yeah, in the bottom of the mountain. Yeah, more like a basement, Clifford.
Okay.
Now, Iluvatar knew what was done, and in that very hour that Aule's work was complete, and he was pleased, and began to instruct the dwarves in the speech that he had devised for them, Iluvatar spoke to him, and Aule heard his voice and was silent. And the voice of Iluvatar said to him, "Why hast thou done this? Why dost thou attempt a thing which thou knowest is beyond thy power and thy authority? For thou hast for me as a gift thy own being only, and no more. And therefore the creatures of thy hand and mind can live only by that being, moving when thou thinkest to move them. And if thy thought be elsewhere, standing idle, is that thy desire? Did that make sense? That was a little bit mouthful.
Help me out.
Okay, so it sounds like Iluvatar is saying, okay, why did you make these beings? Because the only person that's really made beings has been Iluvatar. You know, because like, if we're saying like free will and reason, that's elves and men, and then it's all the Valar and the Maiar, you know? Mm-hmm. But now Ale is creating another race of that. I guess, well, orcs have been created too, but they're like a mock form of elves. And we'll get into that at some point too. But yeah, so this is
like the closest thing, well, the most free will at the level, like the second level of subcreation.
Right. And it's only second level because these guys presumably would be tied to Aule. Like, it's almost like, well, are these things even free themselves, or are they just going to do whatever Aule tells them? You know,
right.
Like, can they actually think for themselves, or are they just going to do whatever their creator says, which is a problem. Then Aule answered, I did not desire such lordship. I desire things other than I am, to love them and to teach them, so that they too might perceive the beauty of Ea, which thou hast caused to be. For it seemed to me that there is a great room in Arda for many things that might rejoice in it. Yet it is for the most part empty still and dumb. And in my impatience, I have fallen into folly. Yet the making of things is in my heart and from my own making by thee. And the child of little understanding that makes a play of deeds of his father may do so without thought of mockery, but because he is the son of his father. But what shall I do now, so that thou be not angry with me forever? As a child to his father, I offer thee these things, the work of my own hands that thou hast made. Do with them what thou wilt, but should I rather not destroy the work of my own presumption? Okay, with me again, that was another mouthful.
Yeah, so Aule is like, okay, you caught me. I didn't want to usurp your power at all. I just, you know, was curious and wanted to make beings that would appreciate the beauty of the world that you have made. But here, you can take the dwarves and do with them what you will. I just, please don't destroy them, because, yeah, I love them.
But he also adds in, too, he just says, well, you know, I'm a creative dude. I make things. That's in my nature, and you made my nature, and I'm trying to emulate you, I guess. You know, like, I'm like a son to you, you know, and you're my father. But that said, I'll do whatever you want, even, well, let's see what happens. Then Aule took up a great hammer to smite the dwarves, and he wept. But Iluvatar had compassion upon Aule and his desire because of his humility. And the dwarves shrank from the hammer and were afraid, and they bowed down their heads and begged for mercy. And the voice of Iluvatar said to Aule, Thy offer I have accepted even as it was made. Dost thou not see that the things have now a life of their own and speak with their own voices? Else they would not have flinched from thy blow, nor from any command of thy will. Then Aule cast down his hammer and was glad and gave thanks to Iluvatar, saying, May Eru bless my work and amend it. Iluvatar spoke again and said, Even as I gave being to the thoughts of the Ainur at the beginning of the world, so now I have taken up thy desire and given it a place therein. But in no other way will I mend thy handiwork, and as thou hast made it, so it shall be. But I will not suffer this, that these should come before the firstborn of my design, nor that thy impatience should be rewarded. They shall sleep now in the darkness under stone, and shall not come forth until the firstborn have awakened upon earth, and until that time thou and they will wait, though long it seem. But when the time comes, I will awaken them, and they shall be to thee as children. And often strife shall arise between thine and mine, the children of my adoption and the children of my choice. Okay, so that's kind of big. You understand it all?
I think so. I need a little bit of help here. So Aule was basically volunteered to destroy his creation.
Right.
Iluvatar stayed his hand and said, You see how they have free will. That means that they're not just your creation. Like, they have life now.
Yeah.
And so they've kind of transcended being just your creation at this point. And then I was a little bit fuzzy in the middle there, but then there's going to be tension with the other children of Iluvatar.
Right. So what Iluvatar says is, okay, so since these guys are just beyond your own creation at this point, I will count them as an adopted children. You know, like I have men and elves are the children of Ulúvatar, mm-hmm. and then dwarves are the adopted child too. You know.
Okay.
But Aule, you're not going to get rewarded for this because you did. This is like not the correct thing to do. The firstborn are the elves. It's not going to be the dwarves. So mm-hmm. we're going to put these guys to sleep, and you're going to have to wait as you were supposed to be waiting this whole time patiently. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're going to suck it up, and that's that.
And at some point, the adopted children are going to fight with the real children.
Right. So it's kind of like natural that the dwarves and elves from the very beginning never see eye to eye.
Okay.
Then Aule took the seven fathers of the dwarves and laid them to rest in far sundered places. And he returned to Valinor and waited while the long years lengthened. Since they were to come in the days of the power of Melkor, Aule made the dwarves strong to endure. Therefore, they are stone-hard, stubborn, fast in friendship and in enmity, and they suffer toil and hunger and hurt of body more heartily than all other speaking peoples. And they live long, far beyond the span of men, yet not forever. Aforetime it was held among the elves in Middle-earth that dying the dwarves returned to the earth and the stone of which they were made. Yet that is not their own belief, for they say that Aule the Maker, whom they call Mahal, cares for them, and gathers them to Mandos and halls set apart. And he declared to their fathers of old that Ilúvatar will hallow them and give them a place among the children in the end. Then their part shall be to serve Aule and to aid him in the remaking of Arda after the last battle. They say also that the seven fathers of the dwarves return to live again in their own kin and bear once more their ancient names, of whom Durin was the most renowned in after ages, father of that kindred most friendly to the elves, whose mansions were at Khazad Dûm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. This could have potentially been around, you know, it was probably in the halls of the caves of Khazad Dûm at that point where Aule made these dwarves, if I had to guess.
Okay.
So we're
near like or that. Where he buried maybe Durin, one of the seven fathers of the dwarves.
Right. Yeah, potentially. Yeah, pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of explains why dwarves are like strong and hardy, you know, but also like, I guess it's saying stubborn and fast of friendship and in enmity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, though, Aule himself for this story, compare this to Melkor, because Melkor... They said Aule is most like to Melkor in that they're kind of like both like creators and like can build stuff and
have many skills under their belt.
Yeah, right? Like but they're craftsmen and like, you know, like a blacksmith almost. Mm-hmm.
At the very beginning of the Music of Ainur, Melkor is impatient as well, right?
Exactly.
And he wants a larger part for himself.
Right.
So he creates discord. And this this could seem a little bit similar here because Aule is also impatient.
But Aule clearly more loyal, and he's prepared to even destroy his own creation because he's that loyal to Ilúvatar.
Mm-hmm. And he says the purpose of his creation was to create some living thing that can enjoy the beauty of the world that Ilúvatar made.
Now, the destroying it, that kind of reminds me of like Abraham sacrificing Isaac. Like, he's prepared to do that. Like, he's that loyal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in that story, he doesn't have to do it either, just like here, and the dwarves survive here. You're right, though. Like, Aule has the desire just for, like, creating things so that they can basically love the world and love Ilúvatar, who is, like, the master of the world and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Versus Melkor. Melkor, whenever he creates stuff now, it always just ends up mocking somebody else.
Mm.
Because he was a creative dude, too, because he's the most powerful of all the Ainur. So you can think, like, okay, Aule, he's, like, a really powerful smith and stuff. Well, that means Melkor has to be more.
Mm-hmm.
But Melkor, in trying to just achieve his own dominance and everything, he just always ends up losing his creative powers, and he just ends up mocking what everybody else has made.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know? Another interesting thought is that Melkor sort of, he really wants a role in the shaping of the world itself. Like, he wants a larger part to play in creating the world. So he wants control, wants dominance in the world, whereas Aule is trying to add something to the world, basically trying to add some harmony to it. Or not even that. He's like on a lower level trying to participate in the world and not trying to shape the world itself in the same way that Melkor is.
And when Aule has his priorities straight, he ends up achieving more than Melkor can.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
who doesn't? And he just ends up just making a mess.
Mm-hmm.
There was that last battle reference at the very end there. Apparently the dwarves get to go to the halls of Mandos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so basically like the houses of the dead almost.
Right.
And they shall serve Ale and aid him in the remaking of Arda after the last battle. Last battle capitalized.
Do we know, have we heard anything, other references to the last battle?
There's one other, I don't think we've heard one yet. There's definitely another one in the Silmarillion itself. But like, I almost thought this idea was out of date, that this last battle thing wouldn't happen, because this is like, you know, end of times last battle.
Yeah, but it's different wording than the final song or the final choir of,
exactly,
of Iluvatar. That's that we heard in the Music of the Ainur.
Yeah, the second music of Iluvatar. Second music of Iluvatar. It's like the final thing. Right, so it's like, well, where does this last battle fit in? You know, like, that's what I've always confused about.
Okay.
Like, I don't think I really have an answer, but I think we have other places where we can talk about this last battle. But let's just leave a note and we can come back to it.
Okay.
All right, I'm recording.
Okay, I am as well.
Okay, cool. Clifford, we're back again. So, we just did the first Moria chapter is what's getting released.
Oh, man.
Yeah, we're so much further ahead.
Well, no, it's getting scary.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, that was a fun chapter. Dude, all right, so editing it. Actually, I didn't even finish editing it. I got to finish that tomorrow. Anyways. Dude, I was editing the Cats of Queen Baruthiel segment thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious.
Yeah?
That was the funniest thing, because, like, especially because it seemed like you're not that into it.
The cats.
Like, you're not that into the most minor character of the entire book. We spent 6 minutes on that.
That's great.
Yeah, and then also, I think we did, like, a pretty good job kind of covering this, but, like, you know, that door gets destroyed by the sea monster.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that thing was like 5,000 years old. Like, seriously, like, yeah, just think about, yeah, like, the perspective on that. Like, imagine like a 5,000-year-old archaeological site today getting, mm-hmm, destroyed. Can you believe that? Like, isn't that crazy? Like, just,
yeah,
all, I mean, the...
It happens. But, yeah, it's super tragic.
Right. But, I mean, yeah, but like, or even like a... I don't know, like a 1,000-year-old thing now. Like, if something got destroyed, I mean, if it's the heat of battle, it's tragic, but still, it's just like, holy crap, that would be...
Yeah, it would be, I guess the equivalent would be like, well, that's twice as old as Egyptian pyramid stuff, right? Isn't that...
No, the pyramids are actually 5,000 years old.
Okay. I get mixed up. They're like 2,500 BC, I think.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it'd be like ripping a doorway off one of the pyramids.
Yeah. Well, a really, really nice doorway.
Yeah.
Yeah. How's quarantine life for you?
It's going well. Yeah. Been dealing with a little back pain that's kept me inside more than I'd like to be.
Yeah.
I'm surviving. Mm. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I really need a haircut, man. That's,
yeah, same here.
This is getting so bad. Yeah.
You getting antsy, or are you staying calm?
I think I'm going to wait it out, because I'm hearing it's going to end at the end of the month for Colorado.
Yeah, that's what they're saying here, too. We're planning to go back to work, but, well, I don't know. I'm a little dubious.
I think I can wait it out. Yeah. Do anything fun this weekend?
Went for a sweet hike.
Ooh.
We biked across the Golden Gate Bridge, which is awesome and kind of scary, and then hiked up a little mini mountain, a large hill on the other side.
Nice.
Which was really cool.
Cool.
How about you?
Super nice Sunday. We played Beersby. That was fun.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that like you
the PVC pipes with the beer bottles on them, and then you throw the frisbee.
Oh yeah, and you have to knock it off.
Yeah.
But you're also holding a beer that you can't put down?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember that.
And you got to try to catch both. Yeah. It was fun. It was a good time. Yeah. Anything else?
No, nothing. Nothing
okay.
For me.
Cool. I think that was a long chapter, so yeah, we can just finish it off. All right. Well, yeah. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Be safe with the quarantine still going on.
Thanks, y'all.
Okay. You can stop recording. My mouse pad is wet, so I can't. not be afraid. I have been with him on many a journey, if never on one so dark. And there are tales of Rivendell, of Rivendell. Is that a typo? Does this book have a typo? Did you say of or in?
There are tales of Rivendell.
That's gotta be a typo. There are tales of Rivendell of greater deeds of his than any that I have seen. That's gotta be in. All right, whatever. Okay.